Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
All right, so we got to go back down memory lane. Your rookie season, literally the first game of your NBA career. Now, everybody's seen that video circulating. I think Kareem has said something about somebody else getting violent, and then they dropped the Kent Benson one-hitter quitter video. That's your first game. If you actually watch the tape, you're going like Jamal Wilkes or somebody. So take me back to that first NBA game. Kareem's back in Milwaukee. Obviously, Kent Benson, you know, you guys were both drafted in the same class. He hits him with that joint. What are you thinking? That's like a minute or two into the game, right?
Yeah, the first NBA game, first minute or two. I remember Kent Benson had made some statements in the papers that morning. The Milwaukee Sentinel, the morning paper. You used to have a morning paper and the evening, the journal. And now they've combined them. But to Bob Wolf, who was this World War II veteran with one arm missing, with the black glove and, you know, pencil in his mouth, you know. But he'd made some comments to Bob Wolf that he was gonna, you know, be physical with Kareem, gonna rough him up, gonna, you know, elbow him, just kind of see how he responds. So that was already out there, you know. And so that was already out there. And so when Kent caught Kareem, and Kent tells a story that, and I don't remember this like he does, but I'm sure the video would bear it out. But he said he jumped over Kareem for an offensive rebound. He, you know, he shot a hook over him to start the game off. How well he was playing. That's what Kent says. So he thinks a lot of it, or some of it, had to do with the fact that he was kind of showing up Kareem early, just in terms of his aggressiveness. I don't quite remember it that way, but that's what Kent says. And so when Kent elbowed Kareem in the solar plexus, Kareem doubles over. I'm guarding Jamal. I can't see any of this. All I hear is, just like that, that's all I hear. I mean, loud enough to turn around, and then that's when I see Kent stumbling around, you know, just stumbling, and then I see Kareem dancing over him. Get up, get up, get up. So I walk up to Kareem, I was just like, he's just like, Cap, he's not getting up, man. Get him, back up, he's not getting up, you know. He's not getting up. And Kent was, he was messed up pretty much that entire season. I remember him saying this, you know, that, how you doing, Benny? He's like, all right, you know, I still have headaches and I see light flashes all the time. And I'm just, you know, he had a hard time with that in terms of migraines and everything else, the residual effects of it. And just coming in, he said, so first of all, he shouldn't have been the number one pick. I should have been the number one pick.
We're going to get there.
Yeah, number one.
I know you feel a certain way.
He should have been the number one pick anyway.
He should have been. Well, we had Swin Nader. Uh-huh. From UCLA, Bill Walton's backup. Twin averaged 15 and 12 rebounds again. We needed a rebounded big man to dominate inside. We had one. They traded Twin to Buffalo to get the number three pick so they could draft me and take Kent Benson number one. And David Falk, the great David Falk, Michael Jordan's agent, he's sitting down with myself and my parents at dinner, and he told my mom and dad, well, you know they're drafting Kent Benson number one because he's white. And why did he say that to my mother? We know he's white, damn it. We know damn well he's white. You ain't got to tell us that. We know he's white. Why you know, what do you know? But so that was kind of that great white hope type of an approach that the league was looking for at that time. It was too black. It was too much going on. And so Quinn Buckner, my teammate, and you know, it's 40 plus years later, so I'm not really throwing him under the bus, but he told Don Nelson, he's like, hey, don't draft Kent Benson number one, you know, he's not so much soft, but he's injured a lot. He had a bad back injury, I think his senior year at Indiana, missed a lot of games. And so he said he tried to warn them that he wasn't the Kent Benson who was a great player his junior year, that he'd actually kind of peaked out and was more of a journeyman type of a good role-playing center as opposed to a guy that needed to be the number one pick and the pressure that came with it. So, but yeah, that was a crazy night, man. And again, I just remember Kareem on his toes dancing like, Ali, get up, motherfucker, get up, get up. You know, and yeah, that was crazy.
What was that fine? $40?
Huh? Yeah. Maybe a couple thousand, maybe. I think he was, I want to say, one of the largest fines in history, maybe.
Oh, that was?
I believe so. Maybe a couple grand or something like that.
You can't do that in Milwaukee.
There was no suspensions and stuff like that.
Well, he broke his hand.
Oh.
With the punch, I believe. I gotta look that up. Don't quote me on that. But I thought he missed some games after that because of the punch, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
So let's move on to your second season. You know, arguably the best season of your career in the league. You knocked Dr. J off the first team All-NBA. You're putting up like 25.6 a game. I think it was third that year behind George Gervin.
And Lloyd Freak.
And World Be Free. So what happens? I mean, obviously you think you got on that trajectory and now you're just going to ride that sky high. I don't think the Bucks made the playoffs that year. But what happens that offseason going into the next year?
We had a lot of injuries that year, specifically Dave Myers, who was my running mate at forward, passed away a few years back of cancer, and Myers' older brother. But he didn't play that whole season, had some sciatic issues in his leg and back. And we were just undermanned and had a, you know, John Gianelli was playing center, former New York Knicks, but he's a 6'10", like, you know, maybe 220-pound guy trying to battle the Bobliniers and the big behemoths of the day inside. So anyway, so that year, but what happened before that, Joe, was that after my rookie year, Don Nelson had me meet him down at Loyola University. It's where the Bucks were having their practices for summer league. So like, MJ, come on down. I want to just, you know, talk to you a couple things about your jump shot. So back in those days, I mean, my shot was here, and it was like a lot of wrists, just kind of a nasty when I look back on it. It was efficient. I could knock it down, but it wasn't aesthetically the best thing to look at. So he worked with me this one practice and said, what I want you to do now, just think about snapping your whole arm. Instead of just shooting with the wrist like you do, just snap your whole arm through. And man, that was like the biggest revelation as far as shooting. We didn't have shooting coaches. There was no Easy Money Sniper or who's the guy? I forget.
Lethal Shooters.
Dave Hoppler.
Yeah, Lethal Shooter, Dave Hoppler. None of that going on. And so I had no clue what I was doing right or wrong. I'm just, you know, it's going in. I'm averaging, you know, almost 20-10 my rookie year. So, hey, I'm good, 55% from the field. So when he showed me that, I went out to this junior high school in Malibu. I was living in Malibu at that time. So me and Ed Waters and a couple of high school buddies, Larry Bowles, went out and played some knockout, you know, just kind of messing around on an outdoor court after he showed me that. And I started using that and I couldn't miss. I mean, it was just like, man, okay, this is all. And so now all of a sudden I got a jumper. So not only am I 6'6", and athletic and a garbage man extraordinaire, you know, buckets on, you know, post up, back to the basket, buckets, jump hooks. Now I got this jumper and this confidence in this jumper. Mm-hmm. And so I came out that second year, and the first six games of that season, I had 30 or more points. And it was a record until Giannis.
Yeah, I remember.
Giannis might have tied it in terms of starting a season with 30-point games. They flashed it on some of the national broadcasts at times. But that's because of that jumper that Nelly had told me about. And so I'm lighting them up. I'm giving them 30s, you know, averaging 26 a game. And me and George Gervin, who's a good friend of mine, Lloyd B. Free, we're talking about who's going to lead the league in scoring. That year, George did. Lloyd was second. I was third. And then I'm like, next year, I'm going to average 30 and come back and, like, show y'all and blah, blah, blah. Just friendly kind of competition. But before that next season, Don Nelson, my coach, brought me in the office, like, MJ, great year last year. Looking forward to this year. What are you thinking? I was like, hey, I worked hard this summer, coach. I'm average close to 30 a game. I average 26. Second year, I'm gonna give him 30 this year. He's like, well, I have no doubt in my mind you can do that. But this is what I want you to do. I want you to average 20, give me about 7 rebounds a game, play some solid defense, and let's kind of spread the scoring out a little bit more, and have a little bit more balanced scoring. And I did that. Now, looking back on it, I wish I would have met him in the middle, you know, and said, like, well, I could average 30. You want me to average 20, so I average 25. You know, let's settle on 25. But so you look at my numbers, I went from that 25.6, next year, like 21, 20, 21, 20.8. But that was at the specific behest of my coach asking me to rein in the numbers. Now, I look back on that, and Don Nelson, you know, I love Coach Nelly, was a great coach and really helped me a lot in terms of where, he came into my life as a basketball player. My rookie year, 21 years old, was his first full year as a coach, and he was really interactive in terms of, MJ, what are you seeing out there? If I come out, Guild, and I have a turnover trying to split two guys and do something, timeout, MJ, what are you thinking? Well, I thought I could split these two guys, coach, get into the gap up in the air, no look, and throw a pass to my left. He's like, okay, you know, I couldn't do it. But yeah, I get that. Okay, that's fine. But he was that kind of coach. But looking back on it, I often look back on it, Joe, and think about, you know, in terms of what was going on with the league, racially, with Ken Benson being the number one pick as just kind of a decent to good caliber center. You know, if I were a white guy, averaging 26 points a game, 22 years old, 23 years old, first team all pro, I don't know if that request would have been made, or if it was made, I almost feel like the league would have come in and say, what's going on with this guy? Why is he not dropping the 30s that we, you know? And so, and not to say that it was racially motivated, but there's probably a little bit of a racial component in there somewhere that, you know, and I want to overdo that aspect of it, but I often think that, you know, if it was a Chris Mullin or somebody like that was dropping 25 a game on a regular basis, shooting 55, 56% from the field. It ain't like I'm shooting 48, 47, 46. It's an efficient, you know, it'd have been an efficient 30. It'd have been 30 with 56% field goal percentage. Mm-hmm. I think I was number one in offensive box plus minus that second year, whatever that is, whatever stat that is.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of stats nowadays. I don't know what the fuck.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know either.
What's so funny is I got that request one year.
Yeah.
So Flip Saunders come in, and we had the meeting, and they always ask you what you think you're gonna do. anywhere from like 27 to 29, you know, probably about, you know, 6-5, you know, had a rough year last year, you know, right? He was like, you know, 27-6. Yeah. We are a playoff team. I said, who's the playoff team? 27-6? We're gonna be 10 games under. I said, well, hold on. Who's gonna get the extra 9 points?
Yeah.
Which player? He was like, yeah, we're gonna spread it around. Who?
To who, right.
I'm asking who? Like, I don't know what, I don't know what film you watched.
Right.
There's a reason I shoot the ball all the time, right. Because the team I have. Yeah. So, okay, what do you think Antoine's gonna have? He was like, he's gonna have about 19, 20. That's what he has right now. Okay, how about Karan? He's about 19, 20. That's what he has right now.
Yeah.
Who's taking my 9? Who are you giving it to?
Right.
Andre Blatch. Like, who's getting these points? Like, so I was like, all right.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm averaging 27-6. 10 games under.
What happened? You average 20?
I'm averaging 27-6.
So you did what the coach asked
you
to do?
Yes, and we're 10 games under.
Yeah, man.
And then Sam Cassell's like, hey, man, just go average 30, man. Just average 30.
Right.
And then that's when I was shooting back up and game was coming. I was like, because if you're telling me not to do my natural instinct.
Right.
That's the problem with telling a guy, you're saying, don't play as hard as you can play.
Right. Don't be who you are as a player.
Like, just, you know, dial it down. Like, don't be 100%, you know, like 85.
Right.
And you're like, all right. So now I'm like, I can take you, but a coach told me not to.
Right.
but I don't think coaches understand what they're saying. You're telling them if a guy can average 30 and you're asking him, what do you think? He'd be like, yeah, I'm going to average 30 this year. And he'd be like, you know, average about 20.
Right.
Think about what he has to do to average 20.
Yeah. And the emotional impact that it has on a, you know, just in terms of, we talk about buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I buying in? If you keep, you know, if I know that you're holding me back, I'm first team all pro.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're telling me you don't want me to be first team all pro. You know, that's not good enough for what we're trying to do here. Yeah. We don't want you to be top five in the world. And it has an impact. It has an impact. It foments a level of I don't want to say bitterness or anger or anything like that, but you know what I mean? It's
no, but that was my Russell Westbrook stuff. Like, what is it mentally doing to him?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Because you're telling the guy to rein it in and to hold it back. And I've trained to play a certain way and to be. And not again, it's not a 30 shooting 42% or 45%. It's a 30 shooting 56%. Mm-hmm. And my thing is that if analytics had been around back in those days, the analytics department would have said to him, like, no, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. You should be shooting more, not less. Yep. You should be averaging 35 with the way he's putting up buckets and putting up numbers and the efficiency he's showing as a player. So it's interesting. And the other thing too is that, so you think balanced scoring, championship. The year that Golden State won the championship in 1975, Rick Barry led the league in scoring, averaging 30 a game. But he averaged, you know, 5 or 6 assists and did a good job. But it's not like there wasn't the template out there that it couldn't be done. It's just kind of how you do it. And if you do it in efficient enough manner, then it could have worked. But again, that's all hindsight. So, yeah. Well, that explains like the drop off of score. That explains
that.
You
have these great answers, but then I love that you always bring it back to answer the question, because we'll go all over the place.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We got a few more for you, then we'll let you get out of here. So we talk about the term point forward. I don't think you've ever tried to take credit for being the first point forward in the league, but you just created the term point forward. So tell me about that story, how that happened. And when you look back, there's been a ton of great point forwards, but I would say who is your guy that you say this guy really personifies what that point forward position means?
Well, how it happened was the 1984 playoffs against the New Jersey Nets, and they had a couple of defensive-minded guards. We had a bunch of injuries. We had, I think Tiny Archibald had quit mid-season because he wasn't getting the kind of minutes he thought he deserved. So he came up with a hamstring injury and he told Lorenzo Romo on the bench, "I'm through." Lorenzo, "What do you mean? You're through this game?" "No, I'm through. I'm through for the year." Never came back. I think Phil Ford might have been on that team, wasn't getting a bunch of minutes. I forgot who else was injured that year. But so we're going with Mike Dunleavy Sr. Mm-hmm. And Mike Dunleavy Sr. at that time was like early 30s, 32, 33, never ever the quickest guy anyway. So Michael Ray Richardson and Darwin Cook from Crenshaw High School, Darwin Cook, they were just spinning him around left and right, just the pressure and just steals. And just, it was just, they were giving him fits. So Don Nelson said, "Look, we gotta break this up. We gotta stop this." And so he said, "Look, MJ, I want you to initiate the offense. And this is how you're gonna do it. So if we run the UCLA cut, you know, instead of being the wing popping out, you bring it up the floor, you dribble to the wing, then we'll have Sidney cut off a bobble in the air and you can hit him in the post, and now we're into the UCLA offense. We're doing the horns, we called it Detroit back in those days, you know, you bring it down the center of the floor, you initiate, throw it to one side, you cut off a..." So after he broke it down, each play, how he wanted me to initiate from the forward position, so I said to Don Nelson, I said, "So instead of a point guard, I'm like a point forward." And so Nelly was like, "Point forward? Yeah, I like that. You're my point forward. I like that." And so that's the first time that phrase was uttered. Now you've got people, Dale Harris, other people who say that they're the ones that said it first. My whole thing is that if you can find some place where in a newspaper article or something where that term is used prior to that playoff series in April, late April of 1984, show it to me. You'll never find that, because that phrase was never used before that moment in that practice, before I think game 3 of that series. Mm. And so that's when the term first started. Now, in terms of Dale Harris, he used Robert Reed, a great 6'7 forward, as his ball handler, initiator, when he had Calvin Murphy on one wing and Mike Newland and these other great shooting guards coming off of screens. Lenny Wilkins in Seattle, the year we played him in 1979 in the playoffs. Johnny Johnson, a Milwaukee guy. The late Johnny Johnson, his son Mitch is an assistant to play to Stanford. His son Mitch is down in San Antonio now. But Johnny was the point forward. He'd bring it up the floor for Lenny Wilkins and Gus Williams, and Dennis Johnson would come off these screens, Lonnie Shelton and Curl and Jack Sickman do a bunch of stuff. So now they played that position before Nelson put me in that position in 84, but no one ever used that term. It's my thing that I came up with the term point forward. And that's my claim to fame. But Rick Barry was a point forward in 75, averaging 6 assists a game. Maurice Stokes, look up some old YouTube of Maurice Stokes in the early 60s, late 50s, playing with the Cincinnati Royals. He's 6'8", 250, bringing it up the floor, starting your offense, kicking it, driving, kick, doing all kinds of stuff. Elgin Baylor was a great ball handler in terms of initiating your offense. Other forwards have done that before, but my only thing, Joe, is that you know, I'm the first guy that ever uttered that phrase, that it was in that situation, that practice, and I just regret I didn't have the foresight to.
Me too, because that would have been a bag, a Rooney. Yeah. I would have had this gap fixed. I could have got the veneers too, really looking good.
Well, it reminds me of Pat Riley and I think it was Byron Scott when the Lakers had won two in a row, and Byron Scott's like, yeah, we go three-peat. And Pat Riley's like, I'm gonna go trademark that. That's good. Pat Riley wouldn't trademark.
Good.
Yeah, that's good. Pat Riley wouldn't trademark it.
Yeah. You know, but Byron Scott gentrified the three-peat.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, three-peat. Okay, I'll make some T-shirts.
All right, so we got two more questions for all you. Right. So you went to the playoffs 6 of your first 7 years with the Bucks. Then you get traded to the Clippers in 1984. People give me a lot of shit now because I'm a LeBron guy. Obviously, I had to swear allegiance to the Lakers. And it's like, well, how was you a Clippers fan? It's like, this is all we knew. I'm 2 years old at this point, but this is all I knew as a kid. But how do you go from, you know, obviously Lakers got the show Winning Time now, Bucks being Winning Time, to the Clippers under Donald Sterling in that whole Losing Time era?
What's the question?
So I'm just saying, what was that transition like for you going?
You bring up some bad memories. Started to twitch, man. No, man, I was. Woo, man. I mean, and it's funny because Don Nelson, before he made the trade, he called me up in that morning and said, "M, I'm sending you to the Clippers." I was like, "Oh, good. Nelly, thanks for sending me home." I was like, "Well, look, before you get all excited, it's not the Lakers." That's the way he talked. It's not the Lakers. They do things differently out there. So just letting you know, you know. And so I get to the Clippers, and first, Donald Sterling had lawsuits against Don Chaney, our coach, for a $200 moving expense, had a $500 lawsuit against Norm Nixon for a moving expense from San Diego to L.A. Yeah, yeah, but he had a bevy of attorneys on retainer. And so, you know, he settled. So instead of the $600, you know, give me $300 and we'll call it a day, you know. And so that was his he's a lawyer. That was his MO. That's the way he operated. Everything was a negotiation. And so, you know, I'd gotten here, and look, I went through drug rehab in 1982. So this is 1984. 1983, I was an all-star. So it's not like I'm damaged goods, right? So I made the all-star team in 83. Went through rehab in 82. Cocaine was a hell of a drug. I mean, it was you know, all the stories about cocaine in the NBA in those days are real. And Snowfall was real back in those days.
Snowfall was real.
So I went to rehab in 82. 83 made the All-Star team, got traded to the Clippers in 84, and I remember Alan Rothenberg, the vice president or president of the Clipper franchise at that time. They asked me, like, you know, are you doing drugs? I'm like, no, at that time I wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like, what time is it, 10 o'clock? No. He called me at 10, no, I'm good. No, so I told him no. And so they found out later that I went through rehab, and so they claimed I was damaged goods and tried to. The funny story I tell is we're walking through Westwood, myself, Chris, your older brother. Chris is about 12 years old or something at the time, and Ed Waters, my good friend, whose coach is Crenshaw now. So Chris is like, "Dad, can I get a Herald Examiner? Can we get a quarter for a Herald Examiner?" Like, here. Give him a quarter, he goes to the paper machine, pulls out the paper, he's reading the sports section. He said, "Dad, what does rescind mean?" I said, "Rescind means to give something back you don't want." I said, "Why?" He's like, "Well, the Clippers are trying to give you back to Milwaukee." So I look at the headline, front page of the Herald Examiner, you know, Clippers trying to rescind trade. Clippers want to rescind Johnson trade. So that's the kind of the cloud trying to operate under at that point, just that public knowledge that, that I had some drug issues and went through drug rehab. And it's funny, when that article came out, I was at home, and my pastor, Reverend Wade, called me up. He's like, I read the article. You okay? I was like, yeah. He said, I'm going to stop by and go for a ride with me. So he came by and picked me up on Innerdale. And he took me over to Reverend James Cleveland's house.
Okay.
And he lived like 4 or 5 blocks away up in the View Park, Windsor Hills area. Went in, he's like, they call him Doc. Hey, Doc, this is Marcus Johnson, and he's going through some things. I just want you to sing a couple songs for him. And then James Cleveland got on the piano, and, you know, I don't feel no ways tired, and sang a bunch of gospel songs. It was the livest thing. And I didn't think it at the time, but when I think back on it, I said that was my first kind of year with the Clippers under that kind of a cloud. And also the first day of training camp, we're running this 2-on-1 drill, Gil. And so the defenders got to try and reach in and deflect the ball or do something. And you got 2 offensive players. So I'm in line. So I reach in and I kind of jar my hand a little bit. And I tell Brad Greenberg, our assistant coach, like, Brad, this somebody could get hurt doing this crap, man. He's like, yeah, this is how we do it in L.A. I don't know how you guys did it in Milwaukee, but just do the drill. You know, like, all right. So my next time around, I reach in again to try and strip the basketball from the offensive player. I break the 5th metal torso, whatever it is, in my right hand, the little bone by my finger and by my little finger. And I break that. The next guy up, Derek Smith, great player, all-star, passed away a few years back from a heart attack on a cruise. But Derek Smith, the next player in line, he reaches in and breaks the bone in his left hand, in his left finger. And that's when they stop. Okay, stop the drill. Stop the drill. But that's how I started. That was the first day of training camp. So I played that whole year under the cloud of the drug stuff, and then also with a broken right hand. And I'm trying to, like, I got to show who I am, that I ain't on no drugs. I'm going to play with this. And my agent, Willie Knowles, kept saying, don't play till you absolutely heal. When you do play, shoot it 30 times a game, average 25 a game. Mm-hmm. I'm like, Willie, I'm going to get out there and play, man, and tape it up, and I get it hit like once or twice a game and re-injure it and whatnot. So I wound up shooting. If you look at my numbers, I think that was the first time and the only time I ever shot below 50% from the field, average about 16.6, which was boo-boo for me. You know, 16.6.
That was 50%. Yeah, I was 42 and I was shy.
But it was just a nightmarish kind of a year. And still, so then the next year I come back and we have training camp out at Cal Poly Pomona. The first year I think it was at Loyola University. We have training camp at Cal Poly Pomona. We're staying at an Econo Lodge. Now, the Lakers are over in, like, Hawaii or Santa Barbara or somewhere. We're at the Econo Lodge out in Pomona. Paper-thin walls. I mean, just the worst conditions you can imagine. And we're practicing at this newly built YMCA on Century in Vermont, the Wine Garden YMCA. One basket is about 9 feet. The other basket is about 8 feet. This is our practice. This is our practice facility. And it was just a low budget, low cut, low rate discount operation that everybody hated playing for. But, you know, we tried to make the best of it and tried to be competitive. And we had some good guys. I played with Norm Nixon and Bill Walton and Cedric Maxwell and Junior Bridgman came out with me from Milwaukee. We had a good time, but just under this whole cloud of Donald Sterling. And I mean, Donald Sterling would bring in just a group of his friends. We're butt naked after a game. They come into the locker room, like, you know, they just, you know, be oogling and looking at us, you know. It was just the weirdest, strangest kind of a setup, man, that you could imagine, man. And it wasn't comfortable at all. And and I would actually think to myself, like, man, and this is what I always say, be careful what you wish for. Be like, man, you know, dang, boy, if I could just get a nice little injury where I could get paid, wouldn't have to show up to all this bull crap every day. And then that next year hurt my neck, November 20th, and that was it. It was a done deal, and my career was pretty much over at that point. But yeah, the Clipper days compared to the Milwaukee days was a nightmare.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Yeah, I remember I was talking to Baron Davis.
Yeah.
No, not Baron. I was talking to Sam Cassell about the Clippers.
Yeah.
Right? I was like, is the Clippers that bad? He was like, We practiced at a YMCA. We put our jersey on a nail. It was like a nail in the wall. Yeah. And we put our practice. And I was like, so what happens like at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, you want to go practice? He's like, it's the YMCA. When the YMCA closed, that's it.
That's it.
So we got to go find like the Spectrum Club. And I was like, how are y'all supposed to get better?
Yeah.
I was like, how are you supposed to get better in the off season? Like, I mean, he was like, you... I was like, y'all worked at a YMCA. He's like, yo, bro, listen, this was probably the only non-NBA team in the NBA. He said, we're an NBA team, but we're not an NBA team.
I remember the LA Times magazine had a feature article on Donald Sterling, and they asked him about his players. So your players, I mean, you know, Dr. Buss, we see how he treats his players. I mean, you treat your players like they're your children. You think of them as your kids. He's like, no, I think of them as racehorses. You know, if one gets hurt, you just get another one and depreciate the value and move on. I mean, so it's just that mindset.
That's how it looked when he drafted.
Yeah.
There was a point where he never actually paid. Because when I was coming up as a free agent, this is 2003. At that point, he never re-signed any of his top players.
Right.
So there was this thing where, like, Lamar Odom, half of his team, half of that, this squad was up for
Darius Miles and Quentin Richardson.
They already got wind, and he said he was letting them all go. He didn't care.
Yeah.
And they were like, no. You're going to have to spend money. You're going to have to sign someone.
Right.
You're not going to just let all these free agents go. So that's when I went, and they were like, oh, offer me like $55 million to come.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, nah.
I'm not fucking with that.
Like, I just didn't want to play here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, the friends, all your friends. And I'm like, yo, I'm trying to, like, I'm really trying to, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about drafts. And quick story. So, Bedoy Benjamin, we drafted him number two or three that one year. I think Tisdale may have went ahead of him and Patrick Ewing. Mm-hmm. And we were hoping for the ping pong ball so we could get Patrick Ewing, and that was going to turn the franchise around. But, you know, we didn't deserve him, the basketball gods. We're going to bless all that. So we wind up with Bedoy Benjamin out of Creighton University, I believe. But he's from Louisiana, Monroe, near where I'm from. So that was my Louisiana homeboy. So Carl Scheer, the general manager, tells me to come down to the sports arena to meet Bedoy, me and Norm Nixon. So we drive down there to meet Bedoy. So Bedoy, you know, freshly drafted, you know, fresh off the plane from Louisiana, wherever. And so Bedoy's first question to me is like, man, call up Kareem, man. Tell him I want to play some 1-on-1. Just like June. Lakers just got out of the finals. You know? Call Kareem up, man. Tell him to come play some 1-on-1 right now. Like, Bedoy, Kareem, you know, but that gives you an idea of his mindset. So that season, Bedoy, he was a piece of work all year long. He was overweight, whatever, whatever. So he wound up this one practice, shoot around at the sports arena. And so we're shooting around. Don Chaney calls us over to go through the other team's plays. And so he's like, so Bedoy, you're going to start? And I was like, Duck, Benoit's not here. He's like, what? Where is he? I said, I don't know. I'm just letting you know he's not here. So Bedoy comes sauntering in right at that moment with a plastic brown leather coat, his basketball shorts, his shoes with no socks, with the tongue of his shoes just flapping and flopping. They weren't tied up. He comes, he just sits down on the bench and just looks at us like this, you know. So Dante's like, Bedoy, get your sorry ass over here. So Bedoy comes over there like, what? So Don Chaney's like, man, see, you're the reason coaches get fired. Guys like you, see, somebody needs to whip your ass. As a matter of fact, and he went to swing at him, and we had to, like, grab Don Chaney, and Bedoy's backing up. But my point is that, so I'm talking about coaches going there. So Don Chaney was going to go there. And so Bedoy, he went down to the other end. I remember coming to him a little bit later in practice. He's working his ass off, jump hooks. I said, Bedoy, you all right? He's like, yeah, I'm fine, man. But yeah, F that motherfucker. He don't mean it. That don't mean nothing to me. But he's working harder than I've ever seen him work. Mm-hmm. From that point on, Bedoy averaged, you can look it up, averaged 23 points, 11 rebounds, 4 or 5 block shots a game. He played like crazy. And he gave us hope that we could turn a corner with him as our center. That offseason, I call up Don Chaney just to touch base. What's up, Duck, man? What's going on, man? You heard from Bedoy? He's like, man, Marcus, that dude's on a cruise, man. He's up to like 285. You know, he got down to about 247. He's back up to 285, man. And that was just kind of it with him. But just that whole the Bedoy Benjamin episodes were just brought two left shoes to a game on the road at one point in time. Yeah, I mean, just his episodes were legendary with the Clippers, man. So.
So we got two more for you. Got to talk about White Man Can't Jump.
Oh,
I mean, I've heard all these shit.
That man but... said he got two more. Five questions ago.
You're right.
You're so good. So, obviously, you know, this is bonding for us. You know, you get to really see what the Johnson family is all about. But got to talk about White Man Can't Jump. Now, everybody knows, and it's funny, man, you talk about all your NBA accolades, college player of the year, all that good shit. There's such a crew now that just knows you from White Man Can't Jump, your iconic character, Raymond. You know, I'm going to go to my car, get my other gun, shoot everybody's ass. But what's the story behind that character?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So Raymond is based on a story that you would hear, one of the first stories you would hear as a new NBA player. One of the old veterans or somebody would tell you the story about a guy by the name of Reggie Harden. And Reggie Harden was just a basketball savant out of Detroit Eastern High School, won three straight city championships, 6'10", 6'11", handle, shoot. One of the greatest players to ever come out of Detroit. But Reggie had issues with heroin. He was a heroin addict. He got drafted by the Pistons. He never played college basketball. He was one of the first guys to go from high school to the NBA without playing college basketball. Mm. Had a chance to play for Tennessee, which is now Tennessee State, but Tennessee A&I back then, for a coach, Hal, I forget his last name, but he was the first, one of the first guys drafted by the NBA. But he never played for him. And so he was a creature of the streets, the east side of Detroit. You know, pimps and prostitutes and heroin addicts and heroin dealers and that whole thing. So Reggie was in the throes of his heroin addiction, and to the deep throes of his heroin addiction. And what Reggie would do, he would not only rob dope houses, heroin houses where he was buying drugs, he put on a mask, but he would also rob neighborhood bodegas or liquor stores or whatever. But he'd come in with that mask on, it's 7 feet tall, and with a gun, and like, give me all your money. Like, so one dude's like, Reggie, come on, man. This is the fourth time you done hit me this month, man. Come on, Reggie, we know it's you. And so Reggie allegedly said, this is a story that that you would hear how they would tell it. This ain't me, you know, and take a grand of money and run. And so that was the basis of that character. So when I saw that in the screenplay and that scene, robbing that store like that with the mask on, I mean, I knew exactly who they were talking about. Now, since, as you know, Joe, I've written a screenplay about the life of Reggie Harding and did voluminous research on him. And, you know, it's a tragic story because he was a guy, Gil, that, and you can look up the numbers, he gave Wilt his first time playing against Wilt as a rookie, like, you know, 27 and 19, you know. Mm. He was dropping serious numbers on Wilt and Russell. And his potential, I mean, Red Auerbach said he could be one of the top 3 to 5 centers in the league, you know, within 3 to 5 years. So his potential was there, but he just could not stay away from the streets. And I even ran into one of his old teammates who told me, I mentioned a story about Reggie dangling a woman over the balcony of a hotel in San Francisco during a road trip. And so I mentioned this to one of his teammates at the time, and the teammate told me, and I didn't know this until I talked to the teammate, very popular, very well-known guy. He told me, like, Reggie was pimping back then. These are two of the women that he had flew in to San Francisco. They were gonna be there for like 5 days. It was a 5-day road trip. You know, they're gonna play 2 games in 4 or 5 days or whatever. And so Reggie had flown these women in from these prostitutes that worked for him from Detroit to service some of the players on the team, and one shorted him of the money. He dangled over the balcony, like, you know, where my money? Don't be trying to shortchange me. And they had to talk him down and all that stuff. So he was a character, and that's what that character, White Man Can't Jump, was based on. But it's a tragic story because he died at 30. He went to prison, Jackson State Prison in Detroit, for robbing dope houses and doing a bunch of crazy stuff, and robbing people on the street. But he went to prison, and was coaching the team up there. It seemed like he was getting his life together. Got into a verbal altercation with a guy on the streets of Detroit, the east side. Got to an argument, and the guy was like, I'll be back. And so he came back with a gun and shot Reggie right between the... Reggie was like, hey, you point that gun at me, you better kill me. Bam, shot it right between the eyes. Walked up on him, he was down on the ground, shot him in the head a second time. And that was it, 30 years old, he was dead, you know. But that potential, I mean, you look up some of his numbers, if you YouTube Reggie Harding, was just a spectacular talent that had a lot of potential, but, you know, drugs, the streets, too much of a lure.
It seems like that era was fun. I mean, just exciting, just...
Yeah, well, there's a story about
Reggie. Like it was still...
They were playing, I forget, maybe it was the Pistons, I forget who the coach was, but he didn't play Reggie in the first half. And so everybody's gathering around in the locker room, you know, and then Reggie's fuming because he ain't played the first half. And all of a sudden you hear a big thud on the ground. And you can probably relate to this, but you look up and Reggie's got a 347 Magnum on the floor of the locker room. And so the coach is like, what's going on, Reggie? I'm like, all I know is I better get on the court in the second half. That's all I know. I don't know what's going on, but all I know. And another time, he had a teammate named Tweety Bird with the Patriots, I think they were playing, but he woke him up in the middle of the night. Rod Thorne told me this story, the great Rod Thorne, NBA executive for a number of years, but had a pistol pointed at Tweety Bird's head, like, Tweety Bird, they tell me you're a racist. Are you a racist, Tweety Bird? You're a racist? Tweety Bird's like, no, Reg, I'm not a racist. Like, okay, because you're a racist, I have to shoot you. You sure you're not a racist? Nah, Reg, I'm not a racist. Okay, all right, Reg, said, okay, Reg, you laid down and went to sleep. Like, okay. I hate racists almost as much as referees.
As much as referees.
Yeah. So another time, last story, Indiana Pacers. He's suspended for not showing up for games and saying my grandmother died five times and going to funerals for 2 weeks. I'll be right back, you know. And so they suspend him. And so Mike Storrin is the general manager of the Pacers. So he's doing an interview, like pregame interview, halftime interview. Reggie Harding, he's got on like a red jumpsuit with a fur coat and all this stuff. Like, Reggie, you know, don't you feel like you're letting the team down by not being available for the playoffs? Reggie's like, nah, it's Mike Storrin, that's his fault. As a matter of fact, I shoot his ass right now. Mike Storrin, I'm going to shoot your ass. It's like, they had to go to black. They had to cut the camera and go to black. Mike Storrin, when I see your ass, I'm shooting your ass, you know. So he was like, it was just a great
thing. So semi-pro.
Yeah. But there was a lot of guys, you know, it was some characters walking around back in those days and some colorful stories and unfortunately his tragic ending, but he was a colorful player.
So last question, and we'll let you dip. Obviously appreciate you for your time. I always like just hearing you tell these stories. I know people will appreciate it because it's shit that we've kind of talked about growing up, but that, you know, is so fascinating to me. But you've been a finalist for the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame now a few times. I know it's kind of wearing on you, but really when you make the argument and the case for you to get in the hall, I think a lot of people don't understand. You got to consider your entire basketball career. That's what goes into it. Career cut short by injury. But, you know, Liddy was with Chris Mullin. I did the Warriors pregame show the other day. First thing Chris Mullin said, yo, Marcus Johnson needs to be in the Hall of Fame. So for you, do you give a fuck about getting into the Hall of Fame? Is it still something that, I mean, obviously you wanted that achievement, that accolade, but do you feel like you're deserving of being amongst those greats?
Yes, definitely feel like I'm deserving, without question. You know, when your grandmother was alive, my mother died, it'll be a year, January 5th. You know, it was more for her at a certain point. Now, trust me, I wanted to get in for myself also, just to not only to be amongst the, you know, illustrious names and greats of the game, but I mean, the Hall of Fame is just, you know, it's a hell of an achievement. But at the same time, it's funny, the year I didn't make it, last year when I didn't make it, I'm at my daughter, your sister Shiloh's game, and the phone rings. I'm about to go in and watch her play, and I look on the screen, it's Walt Frazier, Clyde Frazier. You know, I'm like, oh shit, Clyde. So I was like, what's up, man? He's like, man, you know, Clyde, look, man, this is some bullshit, man. You need to be in the Hall of Fame. Look, they passed over me three times. I was like, you know, I was like, can I quote you on that? Yeah, you can quote me on that. Yeah, you know. And then I finally went in after that. But Clyde was a guy in the NBA Finals who had a 36-point, 19-assist game 7 with the New York Knicks. I mean, that's Clyde. And so he told me he had been passed over a few times and how he'd gotten to that point. Now, there was a point in time, and I shared this with you, Joe, and I shared it with Spencer Haywood, with Bill Walton at Bob Lanier's memorial service in Las Vegas this past summer. And I shared this, like, look, you know, I'm at that point now, I may just withdraw my name from nomination. I'm not tripping. Look, I've had a chance to get in 2 or 3 times. It hadn't happened. They were like, no, don't you do that, man. That'd be the worst mistake you could do. Leave your name in. It's going to happen for you. Just stay patient. So I'm going to stay patient, man. But, you know, it's my peers have validated that I could go. My numbers validate that I could go. You know how that is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you know you know the ball. You know the real ones. You know the real ones that you know, the Bernard Kings and Alex Ingles. Alex was my backup in Milwaukee the first, you know, year I got there. He was coming off the bench behind me and could see the handwriting on the wall and got out of Milwaukee because he knew he wouldn't be able to, you know, crack that starting lineup as long as I was there. And so, you know, Larry Bird, Dr. J, they all know. I mean, they know. We went at it, and I think you look at my numbers, I think comparatively, I think I outscored Bird. I think Doc has an edge on me. Bernard King has an edge. But I looked up some comparative numbers after Eddie Johnson on one of those serious radio shows. Mm-hmm. He compared me and him, like, look, I outscored you, you know. I was like, well, Eddie, you know.
Relax.
Yeah, right.
Relax.
Yeah. Okay. But the point is that, yes, I believe I deserve to be in that. Especially when you look at the whole body of basketball work, being one of the top 10 players, used to be top five, but now top 10 guys that come out of LA with all of the greats we've had, college player of the year, first Wooden Award winner, you know, first team all pro a couple of other times, when they only had two all pro teams. They would have had three all pro teams back in those days. It would have been, you know, four, five, six times all pro. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, based on the whole body of work, yes, indeed. And yes, it would mean a lot to get in, and I'd be honored and that whole thing. And yeah, it meant a lot more if your grandmother, my mom, was still alive, but it would still mean a lot to me to be included amongst that number of great, 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 great players that I've respected and admired and appreciated their skill level for years and years and years, all my life. Mm.
Well, shit, that about does it.
Let's get it in.
Let's get it. Nah, but you know, Marcus, Dad, we appreciate you pulling up to the show. Thank you so much for coming through.
Yes, sir.
Sitting on the pleather, the leathers. It's been another episode of No Chill with Gilbert Arenas. We'll be back with more very soon.